I'm Tony Harper and welcome to a special edition of the Fox Football Podcast. Wednesday, November 29 marks 20 years since one of the biggest nights in Australian football.
The match is over.
95,000 fans crammed into the MCG to witness the Socceroos advance past Iran to qualify for the World Cup for the first time since 1974. With 15 minutes to go, it was all going to plan, but then everything turned to dust, with two goals eliminating Terry Venables' team.
Heartbreak for Australian soccer. They have been beaten here at the MCG by the away goals rule, the cruelest of fates for the Socceroos.
The boss of Soccer Australia, as the FFA was known back then, was David Hill, who has written about his many roles in Australian sport in an excellent book called The Fair and the Foul, Inside Our Sporting Nation. It's a great honour to have him in the Fox Sports podcast bunker with me today. David, does that night at the MCG still keep you up at night?
Well, it's unforgettable. Anybody, not just me, but anybody that was there, nearly a crowd of 100,000 at the MCG, which was by far the biggest crowd soccer ever, to that point, soccer ever attracted in Australia. But the millions of people who were watching it on television, I don't think anyone who was old enough to have remembered the game then will ever forget it.
No, I concur with you there. I was in the press box that night. It was quite an incredible occasion. Johnny Warren's tears afterwards stand out.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, the story was that we had gone to Iran and got a one-all draw, so we got a valuable away goal, and came back to play the second leg in Melbourne, and were leading 2-0, but hitting the crossbar and the posts all the time. We all thought we should have been ahead 5 or 7-0, but we were 2-0 ahead and coasting with less than a quarter of an hour to go, and then the unbelievable happened, and Iran scored two goals and equalised the game, and as you point out, went through to the World Cup finals on the away goal rule. We became the first country in the world to be eliminated that night from a World Cup undefeated, because we'd either won all of our qualifiers and we'd drawn against Iran the week before, and two draws and wins, no losses, and yet we were still... So that added to the disappointment.
I think there was one other Caribbean nation, but also France were the only other teams who
Trinidad. That was, I think, that was later, Trinidad and Tobago.
Oh,
in CONCACAF.
Yep.
I don't think it was that World Cup, but it still makes it even harder to take that you're undefeated. Mind you, we had a much more difficult qualifying route for the World Cup then than we do now, because you know we went 24 years trying to qualify for the World Cup and. As part of Oceania, now we're part of Asia, which I always wanted, and I'm delighted to see soccer finally achieved it. And, of course, we've qualified for the last four World Cup finals in a row.
A remarkable achievement, really.
Well, I just think it's a more generous qualifying route now than we had at the time.
If we go back to that, the man in charge, who I mentioned at the top, Terry Venables, how did LTEL come to be... aligned with the Socceroos?
Well, I remember Venables because I lived in was working in London in the 70s, and I was a great fan of Venables as a player, and a great fan of his as a coach of Spurs and Crystal Palace, and I remember him playing for QPR and Spurs and Chelsea, and we all follow what happens in England, and you might recall he was the England coach up to and including the Euro 96, which was hosted by England. But they didn't sign him up for the 1998 World Cup. And he said, hey, to the FA in England, hey, this isn't right. You always sign up a coach for a World Cup cycle. And they said, let's see how you go in Europe. And being a very proud and indignant sort of a bloke, Venables spit the dummy and said, no, if you don't sign me up before Euro 96... for France 98 as well, the World Cup, I'm not available. And they called his bluff. So Venables announced that he wasn't staying after Euro 96. Now, about that time, and of course he had a phenomenally successful Euro 96. They were knocked out on a penalty shootout at Wembley.
And they haven't been that good since.
No. Yeah. In fact, I think you could mount an argument that Venables has been the most successful England manager since Sir Alf Ramsey won the World Cup in 66. And most English football supporters would agree with that. Venables, and he's demonstrably a fantastic international coach. Well, about the same time that we're following this story in England, Eddie Thompson, the Australian Socceroos coach, announces after several years of fairly successful coaching, he wanted to move on and took a very well-paid job coaching Hiroshima in Japan, leaving us, of course, with no coach. And I think everybody was, and there was a lot of criticism of me when we appointed Venables because a lot of people said it has to be an Australian coach. My view is...
They're still saying it.
I know. Yes. Yeah. And, but what happened, I didn't know Terry Venables at all personally, but there was a temp who was a backpacker temp working in Soccer Australia, as it was called at the time. And I was just at the water cooler or the having a cup of coffee and talking to her. And she told me that she had worked previously for the FA at Lancaster Gate in London. And I just said, do you know, did you meet Terry? And she said, oh, and she was a Londoner. Oh, yeah, she says, they're all stuffy in there except Tell.
Right.
He comes around and says hello to everybody. And I said, I said to her, and I haven't told this story before. I said to her, you wouldn't be able to get a contact number for him because I'd like to talk to him about coaching Australia. And, of course, she's just a backpacker. So I remember I lent her my mobile phone.
Right.
And she took it home overnight because of the time difference. And the next morning, I went and got the phone back, and she said, he'll talk to you, but no promises.
Right.
And that was enough. So
did she get a bonus?
We should have given her a bonus. So I flew over to London. I phoned him, and he said, well, I'm not sure about this, you know. But I flew to London, and Basil Scarsella, who was then the deputy chair from Adelaide, he came for the first few. He couldn't stay long, but he came and for the first few days. And Terry was very undecided. And he said, you're not going to pressure me into it. And I said, I don't care how long you take, but I'm staying until you make a decision. And I met him first in the daytime in his nightclub,
right.
Scribes, which was a very famous and infamous nightclub. And I stayed in a hotel just across the road. It was called the Royal Palace Hotel, which is where they celebrated the 1966 English World Cup final.
Okay.
In the hotel. Anyway, I was there for a week or 10 days before he finally made a decision. It was very interesting. I think the idea of the distance he found a bit daunting. The idea that he's Australia.
Yeah.
Cool. And I think his wife, Yvette, was a very positive influence on the decision. I think she thought this would be a great adventure. You know, it'd be a good break from all the politics of the English football scene.
I can't imagine Soccer Australia at that time as one of the richest federations going around as well. Was money an issue with Altel?
No. He Venables, I was surprised, was not very interested in the money. We had a lucky break because... it turned out, I didn't know this until I joined Soccer Australia, the old Commonwealth countries had members of the FA, very old colonial empire thing, and we had a guy called David Hill Wood, who was
from
English.
Arsenal? Yeah.
He's from the Arsenal family, yes. The Hill Woods who have been dominant in Arsenal for many years. And David Hill Wood had worked out here in the 70s during the mining boom as a stockbroker in Melbourne, and I think... He had been Australia's representative on the FA. Nobody knew. Nobody in Australia knew. We had this quaint empire thing where this Englishman is our representative on the FA.
Was he taking a fee?
No.
Okay.
But anyway, I found him. And he was very unimpressed with Tell because, of course, there was great friction between the FA in England and Terry. But he very indiscreetly told me what they were paying Terry to coach England. Not the millions of pounds they do now.
Yeah.
They were only paying him 200,000 quid.
Right.
Now, converted into Australian dollars at the time, it was about $400,000. Yeah. I couldn't believe that. That was well within our budget. I mean, for a world-class coach. So I offered Venables the same. The only, his lawyers, insisted that we write the contract in Australian, in British pounds, because the dollar was sliding, and I wanted to write it in Australian dollars. But when, that was the one concession we had to make, these lawyers' insistence that it was written in British pounds, and as the dollar slid, it cost us a bit more. But it was a phenomenally cheap price for a world-class coach. And Venables, coaching the Socceroos, he coached us in 24 games, and I remember the statistics. He won 16, drew 3 and lost 5. It's, I mean, a phenomenal record. We'd never been in FIFA's top 50 world rankings until Venables, and we got into the top 30 for the first time. We've been there since. But he had a fantastic... And what I liked was he wasn't about drawing games.
I recall Eddie Thompson... was a dour coach, and there was that talk, you know, that the perpetual talk within Australian football of tactics and style. And Eddie Thompson was a very draw-related, tight coach. And Venables sort of, it was a renaissance of that right team.
He was about scoring goals.
Yeah.
And I think in those 24 matches, we scored, the figures, we scored 40, nearly 50 goals, and we had, I think, 5 scored against us.
Right.
It was really an mind you, a lot of that was Oceania World Cup qualifiers, which were easy. But we played and drew against Brazil. Mm. We beat Mexico. We beat Chile. Mm. I mean, we beat some world-class teams in that Venables era. I thought it was so refreshing, so refreshing. He came out, and there was a lot of criticism, you know, from the entrenched soccer fraternity and from the soccer media, why are you picking this Englishman and why aren't you picking a local? But as soon as Venables got here, he came for a Four Nations tournament. Australia, we hosted it in Australia, and it was Australia, New Zealand, Norway. Can't remember the fourth team now, but we beat them all.
Right. Yep.
And zoomed up the FIFA rankings, and it was a statement, you know, that Australia is playing a different game.
And he wasn't here to take a wage, obviously. You talked through the money aspect of it, but also he had that, having taken England so far in Euros, he probably had a desire to prove them wrong about not taking him on.
I think not making the World Cup final, which was the single most disappointing moment in the history of Australian sport. Mm. I mean, it was that big an issue. But think of poor Venables. I mean, he had spat the dummy probably against his own interests and told the English FA, if you don't sign me up now, I'm not available. Mm. So he walked away from England, who qualified for France, and he takes up the cudgels for Australia, and they would have said, Australia, and he was going to show them. He was going to prove to them, and nearly did, but he didn't. Can you imagine? I remember after the 2-2 draw, I remember Venables, I sat with him at the press conference in Melbourne after the game, and all he could say was, I'm gutted.
I've never been in a more miserable press conference than that one.
Well, nor me. And I was there by default because the FIFA rules are you've got to have the coach and the captain.
Alex Tobin.
Yeah. Alex, very decent fella, very sensitive fella. The dressing room after that match in Melbourne was the worst scene I've ever seen in sport. It was just devastating. And Tobin was physically and emotionally incapable of getting to the press conference.
What was devastating about it? What was the sort of, talk us a bit more through the mood on what it was like?
Well, I suppose you have to go back the previous week when we went to Iran.
Yeah, let's start there.
All right. So we go to Iran, and which was an adventure-filled event. I remember before we went, logistically, we didn't know we were going to play Iran until 5 days before the game, 6 days before the game, because we had to play the fourth place team in the Asia qualifiers, Australia having won Oceania, which is the Pacific Islands and New Zealand. And we heard in the early hours of a Monday morning that Tuesday morning, that the following Saturday night we're playing Iran in Tehran, because they had won a playoff against Japan in Kuala Lumpur. And I think of the squad, we had less than half the players in Australia. We had quite a handful in Britain, in Scotland and England, and another handful playing in continental Europe. So we had to get them all. So we decided to go to Dubai first. And so we camped in Dubai for a few days, got everybody together, did all our training, and just went into Tehran. We flew into Tehran. I think we took a chartered flight in the day before. And on advice from Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, we took our own water and took our own food. They said, you know, don't chance anything. And we checked into the old Hilton Hotel, which was pre the Iranian Revolution. It'd seen better days. And we took our own cooks and so on. And the Iranians took great offence about this and said that we had insulted their country by saying we had to take our own food and water into Iran.
Better safe than sorry.
Better safe than sorry. Anyway, so we get to Tehran. It was very tense. Everywhere we went, we were surrounded by armed guards. And it was, if it wasn't intended, it probably was. But even if you're charitable and say it was just part of the way they do things, it was a very intimidating environment. I remember arriving at the ground. And bear in mind, at that point, Iran hadn't been beaten in an international match at home for 20-something years. And we got there, and it's 129,000, largest football crowd I'd ever seen, all men. And we went out onto the field, and Venables made the kit stewards, me, the team doctors, the physios, everybody had to go out with the players, sort of strength in numbers, before the game. And we went out, and the 129,000 Iranian men, all in white robes and all waving green and white Iranian flags, were whistling. It was deafening. And it was so Venables was going to let the players become familiar with this really hostile environment. It was deafening whistles. And I remember Venables was shouting at me from 1 or 2 metres away, and I couldn't hear him. It was so intimidating. And I thought, well, I'm glad I don't have to play in this. My wife was with me. But she was only one of two women that were allowed in. The other was the wife of the Australian Trade Commissioner who had married an Iranian woman. And they had to wear the abaya, their head covered with the abaya. They had to be kept in the back of a van until all the men were in, and then they were secreted up the back stairs and into the box with us. And so you can imagine how we felt when Harry Kewell scored. It was funny because when Kewell...
What was the noise like then?
Definitely silent. And I remember leaping out of my seat. Yeah. My wife did, and so did Basil Scarsella, the deputy chair, leapt out of his seat. And we were, and there was just deathly, not only silence, but stillness. And we all looked around. Was it a goal? And the ball was in the net for sure. And, of course, it was a goal. And we came away with a 1-1 draw, and that was very valuable. And we flew back to Dubai and connected with the...
Did you have the Qantas charter with the massage tables and the funny glasses?
No. We were a first because Australian football had always thought small and thought poor and always travelled their squad's economy, and we at least travelled the squad business class, and it was a recognition of that we're playing at the top of the world. We'll do it as the top of the world does. But we didn't have the money that the FA has demonstrated it's got now. So no, it wasn't that lavish.
There were some real characters in that unit. Obviously, we all know Bozza, Fox Sports legend. Viduka as well, and guys like that. How did Venables get on with those guys? How did he relate? He would have had Gazza and people like that.
Dennis Wise, Paul Gascoigne. I mean, they were really hard to manage. Venables was a player's coach. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never come across a player that didn't worship Venables as a coach. He had backed the players even when he shouldn't have.
Right. Examples?
Well, I think that episode on the British Airways flight from Hong Kong to England with Paul Gascoigne when they a lot of damage was done. I mean, also Dennis Wise, who was Chelsea's captain and played for England, who Chelsea dropped as captain after a late night blew with a taxi driver in London, and Venables took no action against him as an England player. And I think that was just Venables demonstrating, because he was a lad from the East End of London, and he was a player's player.
How'd you get on with Bozza?
Oh, well, you've reminded me of an incident. When we were in Dubai preparing for the game, it was bloody hot, you can imagine. And so the squad trained in the mornings and then would have lunch and a rest in the real heat of the day and have a bit of a run in the early evening. And I remember after lunch one day when the players were all in their rooms keeping cool and resting, I went for a walk around the gardens of this fabulous hotel we stayed in. And we were the only guests. It hadn't even opened to the public. And the Australian squad had this huge seven-star hotel to ourselves with these lavish gardens down to the sea. And I went for a walk with Venables, and we walked past all these swimming pools and these bars, and there was one customer in a a big cane armchair with a big goblet of cognac smoking a cigar. And it was Bosnich.
Of course it was.
And as we walked past, Bosnich said, "Mr. Chairman," as he used to call me, "coach." And I didn't quite know how to react. And Venables just locked his jaws, nodded hello and walked on. And I thought about it later. I thought, that's so Bosnich.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have been there. He shouldn't have been smoking cigars and drinking cognac and not resting as the rest of the squad were. But no great damage done. And Venables didn't make a big issue of it, but, you know, made it clear he didn't totally approve of it. He just nodded hello and kept walking. And I thought that was a great, that small incident was a great demonstration of Venables' judgment about players. He didn't want that to become a divisive issue between him and Bosnich, or Bosnich and the team.
The team comes home. I remember a lot of hype around Harry Kewell at the time. He was only young. He'd scored that opening goal in that tie, and he was coming back to an MCG that was going to be a sellout as well. I mean, what are your recollections of him as a breakthrough Socceroo?
An exception. He was exceptional. I mean, people forget that Kewell, who was a great footballer, just how good he was at such a young age. For Australia and then for Leeds United after that. But geez, what a fantastic squad. Mm. You know, if you look at the current squad and compare it, we were lucky. I mean, they've done well to qualify for the World Cup and we didn't. But that squad of that Venables coached was arguably the best Socceroo squad we've ever had. Just rattle off the names. Harry Kewell, Mark Viduka, Robbie Slater, Mark Bosnich, Paul Okon, Ned Zelich. I mean, they're just some of the names. I mean, these guys were all playing in the best leagues in the world. And, I mean, compare it with our current squad. We hardly have a player playing in the top leagues of the world as we did then.
True. And the 2006 edition of the Socceroos has looked back, you know, fondly as a golden generation, but really, you look at that team. How far might they have gone?
Oh well, I think knowing Venables, we would have gone beyond the group stage. What was interesting is after we were eliminated from the World Cup in 1997 on that November day that we're recognising was almost was exactly 20 years ago today. Immediately after the loss, we were the champions of Oceania and we had to play in what was called the Confederations Cup the following week.
Yes. Yeah.
The following week. So having been eliminated from the World Cup, we had to still pack our bags and get to Saudi Arabia, where we played the likes of Chile, Mexico, Brazil, the world champions, and we got through the group stage to the semi-finals, and which is a measure. I mean, the credit to the guys to pick themselves up after this crushing disappointment and to get against the world's best, get into the semi-finals. And, of course, we were knocked out ignominiously. Viduka was sent off, I think, in the 19th minute. You do not play Brazil with 10 men. And we got
it'd be hard enough with 12.
Yeah, it'd be hard enough with 12. Yeah. And but it was an indication of just how good that team was, that to pick itself up after the crushing exit from the World Cup, go to Saudi Arabia the following week and then turn that on, was a measure of just what a class act of a team it was. And look, I'm not being critical, but the current team have done extremely well. No wonder it took so long, you know, the Syria, the Honduras and so on, because historically, I know nobody wants to say this and nobody wants to hear it, it's not a very good squad compared with what we previously had.
True. That game in Melbourne at the MCG, and you're preparing for that, and it's becoming obvious that you're going to get a crowd over 90,000. How did that sort of feel to you as a moment within your...
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic. We, for the first time, I remember Jeff Kennett, the Premier of Victoria, and an old AFL supporter, but also a great lover of football, a great lover of soccer, said it was that night was the proudest he's ever been as an Australian. And I remember the parachutist who came down said that they've never heard a crowd. And there's something about football crowds that are louder and more passionate. You know, in the 2006 when Aloisi scored that penalty, my twin brother, who's a rugby supporter, he said to me, he's never before or since had a crowd that was more animated and more involved. And you can imagine, in 97, that match against Iran at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, a record crowd, the largest crowd we'd ever seen at a football match by a long mile. It was it was the proudest I've ever been to be Australian. I got to the ground early, and I walked right around the outside of the MCG as everybody was arriving, and there were Argentinians wearing their Australian flags. They're Argentinian migrants who have lived here now, and they've put their Socceroos scarf on top of it, and the Greeks, and it was the great mix of Australians at their proudest. One of the things we did, which paid, I think, was when we were in Iran, I was impressed that this huge crowd of Iranians were waving the green and white Iranian flags. And I thought, so I phoned... Right. Phoned back here to Stefan Kamaz, who was largely running the game here, organising the game with Melbourne Major Events. And I said to him, order 50,000 flags. Now, he only had 4 or 5 days to do it. And he managed to get 30 or 35,000 flags, Australian flags. Mm. And there were boxes, and there weren't enough staff at Soccer Australia to distribute them. So Stefan and his staff were handing boxes, not just handing a flag to the supporters.
They're saying,
take this box up to, Bay 13 and hand them all out. And they did.
They did.
And I don't know, if you look at the television coverage now of that game, you can get it on YouTube. Mm. Yeah. And what a wonderful sight. And I remember the Victorian Premier, Jeff Kennett, saying that it was the proudest moment he had ever experienced as an Australian. Mm. The national anthem and the flags and the joy. And it was the most joyous event.
And it got better and better. And then, and then what happened? Was it Peter Hoare? And Peter Hoare was the famous sort of pitch invader, and he did racing events, and he came on and disrupted many sporting events and many other cultural events as well. And with Australia cruising, I guess, at 2-0 up, and as you said earlier, having... had a couple of near misses and maybe should have been further ahead, he came on and he attacked the net, and the game was delayed.
Well, put it this way. When Peter Hoare came in and tore down the nets, and the ref had to stop the game while they rewired the net, and the fact that it took 10 minutes was a bit irritating. But up until that point, Australia was coasting at 2-0 and had missed, hit the crossbar and missed several other chances. But I was more relaxed than anybody. I thought, I've never seen Australia in so much, so far in front, coasting. Iran was shot to bits. You know what was interesting to me about when the game stopped? I looked on the field anxious about the momentum.
And it was the Australians who were moving around, kicking the ball around, keeping the momentum, keeping the body warm. The Iranians were standing still with their legs apart and their hands on their hips and their chins on their chest. They were gone. I thought, they're gone. They're finished. They've nothing left there. And whereas Australia had still had the vim and the desire and the eagerness to get on with it and finish on top. So it was a hell of a surprise to me when they finally got the net fixed and they'd taken Peter Hoare away and to jail. And I remember Jeff Kennett later saying that it was an argument for bringing back capital punishment. and then those terrible, terrible 10 or 15 minutes when Iran scored two goals, and under the FIFA rules, we had a one-all draw away from home. They had a two-all draw away from home. They go through on the away goal rule. We're undefeated, but we're out.
What happened, do you think? If it wasn't Peter Hoare, what was it?
Well,
Is it just the tension of football?
I think that's just football. Certainly the tempo had halted. I thought Australia was maintaining the momentum, but obviously didn't. A couple of mistakes at the back that weren't there anywhere in the earlier qualifiers. And that's just football. And I think people expect it. I think people were very disappointed in me as the chairman, having to account for this diabolical incident.
There was a lot of blame going around, but surely you weren't getting the blame on that.
Well, I tell you where I think I got the blame. Normally when something like that happens, people want action. They want some retribution. They want some sacrifice. They want the coach sacked.
Yes.
The only explanation I could give, and still the only explanation, that's football.
Yeah.
That sometimes, sadly, happens in football. And I think people, the passionate soccer supporters, I mean, bear in mind, you've got the great Johnny Warren on SBS who covered the game live in tears. All of our staff were in tears. The players were in tears. I mean, this was devastating, having gone so far. And I think the quality of the play under Venables, the string of wins we had had, the goals we had scored, we'd captured the hearts for the first time of all Australians to soccer, rather than rugby league or rugby union or Aussie rules or whatever, and we failed to deliver when it looked so promising. And I think we were so far up the hill, it was a long way down the other side.
It was a long way down. Did you feel, you said you looked at the Iranian players and you felt they were gone. Did you feel like you were there? I was in the press box, as I said, and I was working for the Associated Press and was told that if the Socceroos qualified for the World Cup, I was going to France. And I've got to tell you, I was packing my bags. But I wasn't the only one. There were probably six or seven others of my close friends who were in the same scenario. And then obviously you've got to work. I mean, in the stands, are you sitting there playing that in your mind as well, what it's going to be like?
I was sitting, my wife was on one side and the deputy chair of soccer, Basil Scarsella, was on the other. And Basil was still nervous. Mm. And I had to say, for Christ's sake, Basil, it's over. Go home and pack your bags. We're going to Paris. Oh, no, I got it horribly wrong. The difference was I wasn't the least bit tense. Australia was so far ahead in the game.
That's changed the way I watch football now. I struggle to watch football and ever think that it's over. And football has taught me that, and it's probably taught you that as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I remember after the game going to the dressing room, and it's the worst scene I've ever encountered in sport. The players were physically sick. I mean, so distressed. Can you imagine for them? I mean, what this would have done for so many of their careers. I mean, a lot of them were playing in the top leagues anyway, but they're going to go on the greatest sporting stage of all, the World Cup finals, as winners. And they knew they could go through the group stage. They were good enough to do it. And you know, they when there was a lot of criticism of us appointing Venables, not among the players, the players thought this was fantastic, a world-class, world-top coach. And it was all over. They're out. They're going to watch it on television like the rest of us.
What did Terry say to the players? Can you recall?
He had the composure, and there were some fantastic photographs. He went out onto the field because a lot of them were just physically incapable of getting off the field at the end. They just sunk almost into the turf. And Venables went out to console them and tell them that they'd done the best job they possibly could. But immediately after the game, of course, the coach and the captain are obliged to attend within 20 minutes. FIFA rules, they've got to turn up at a press conference. It was a giant press conference. And Alex Tobin, the captain, was just physically and emotionally incapable of getting there. So I had to go with Venables to the press conference. And Venables was pretty speechless. Gutted. I was gutted. Yeah. I again think people expected something more dramatic of an explanation from me. And I could only say, well, that's football. And I made it clear, is this the end of Venables? No. Mm. Venables has been fantastic for Australia.
Did he want to stay then?
He wanted to stay for the...
Confed Cup?
Well, the contract was up to or including the World Cup, so he was contracted, I think, until the following year. And after the Confederations Cup, we played against... we went to Croatia and got a shellacking. He gave a lot of the young blokes their first run with the Socceroos against a fantastic... And I think Croatia made the quarterfinals in the World Cup, so they're a good team. I think his enthusiasm waned after failing to get to the World Cup. But sure, it would have to. I mean, that was the purpose of him coming here.
Well, what about the idea of a foreign coach? It's something we're going through now. I mean, firstly, what do you make of Ange Postecoglou's decision to qualify us for a World Cup and then not go?
I don't understand it. I would have thought going to a World Cup is the absolute pinnacle. I saw Ange Postecoglou talking about football at a Dunbar Football Club luncheon earlier this year, and I was impressed. But I haven't been impressed with the way he's handled this, to be honest. You know, I've got a lot of time for Angie, but, you know, all of this Hamlet type doubt of the meaning of life and so on. You know, Australians wanted a clear answer earlier than this. I don't understand why, but it's his decision. I don't get it. But nor does Football Australia. No. They're saying they're puzzled by it too.
Yeah.
I'm puzzled as well. And I would hope that at some stage Ange will do us the courtesy of explaining why. He doesn't have to go into personal detail. But, you know, none of us have got any bloody idea why he's going. He's obviously been good for Australia, and a credit to him. He's made the World Cup finals. Mm. And, you know, that was what was asked of him, and he delivered. So good on him for that. And he's clearly, we know this from his A-League and NSL coaching, he's a very talented coach.
What would you do right now?
Well, I think... You want Australia to play at the highest level in the world against the world's best, you've got to have the world's best. You can't do anything about the players, you're stuck with what's available. But the coach, like we did with Terry Venables, we went and got the best coach, and it paid off. So, no, I'm not xenophobic. I don't think, you know, I don't have a fear of the stranger and the outsider. There are very, very few countries in the world, and they're much better at football than us, who indulge themselves in the satisfaction of only ever selecting a national as their coach. Germany, Italy, Spain, but that's about it. And there may be a few others, but basically most teams say if you're going to compete against the world's best, you've got to have the world's best, particularly when it comes to the critical issue of coaching. So, look, due respect to Graham Arnold and all the other people who are being... touted. I mean, Arnold has been phenomenally successful at Sydney FC. He's turned out to be... And great players don't often make great coaches, but Arnold has. But whether or not you should eliminate, you know, 90% of the potential world-class candidates as Australia's coach because they're not Australian.
And it'd be a job that people would covet as well, that the big managers would covet.
Certainly, because it's a very short-term World Cup finals.
Yes. Yep. The hard work is done, really.
The hard work is done.
Unless you draw Germany, Spain and Sweden, perhaps.
But. Yeah. When's the draw? Is this
December 2.
December 2, yeah. Well, you know that you're not going to draw three of the world's best in your group of four because they break the 32 teams into four groups. So the best eight are drawn in the first, each of the first eight, the second eight, third eight, and the fourth eight in terms of FIFA rankings.
Yeah, unfortunately, Spain's in pot two and Sweden's in pot three. So I'm looking at it from a completely doomsday scenario, David, which is the negativity.
Germany, Spain and Sweden.
Yeah, before November 29, 1997, I was a really positive kind of bloke. But since that night, I've changed my mind, my attitude to life generally.
Oh, I think Australia's, obviously, it's going to be very challenging because, you know, if you look at the squad, it's not as strong, in my view, as we've had earlier, and we've never got beyond the group stage. So it'll really be an achievement if we go beyond the group stage.
Your time in charge of Australian football was deeply political. Nothing really seems to have changed in Australian football either.
No, it's sad, isn't it? It's sad about soccer. I've never done anything that was such a quagmire.
Because of course you led the ABC and North Sydney Bears in rugby league as well.
And I ran the railways
and the railways
with a staff of 40,000 people.
So it's gone off the rails more in football than it has in the railways.
Well. I'm very pleased with what I did at football, or tried to achieve at football. I think they've done a fantastic job since, but the politics haven't gone, have they?
No.
Since I left, we tried to broaden the appeal of National Football League, Soccer League, into the mainstream of Australian society. And, you know, we entered Perth Glory, Northern Spirit, Carlton in Victoria, Collingwood in Victoria. Some of that worked, some of it didn't, horribly didn't work. I like the way they were able, I wished I'd been able to wipe the slate clean and start again with an A-League. In fact, the A-League was largely designed by Stefan Kamaz, who had run the National Soccer League. So Stefan knew what it needed. And I think what they've done with the A-League is phenomenal. I think getting into Asia, I tried to get Australia into Asia and out of the backwater of Oceania, but failed. And the current administration has been able to do that. And, of course, by getting into Asia, it's an easier qualifying route for the World Cup, getting four out of four qualifications for the World Cup soccer final. So,
but it builds the game as well because the qualifiers are that much, there's plenty more of them with plenty more at stake in it.
Sure. I agree. I think they've done a fantastic job, but it's a shame that there's something about soccer or football, as we should call it. And I only in interviews like this call it soccer, just to, with sporting enthusiasts.
Yep.
You say football, they've got to guess. Now, which of the
I find it's a certain age, David. I call it soccer as well, but also to differentiate between other codes. But
Well, you want your viewers and listeners to be able to instantly distinguish. We're not talking about rugby league or Aussie rules or rugby union. We're talking about football.
On this podcast, they know what they're getting. They know it's Fox football.
Well, I'll call it football from now on.
Sure. I guess you mentioned that you wanted to make the game's appeal broader. Now, I mean, some side of that argument is that, and I read recently that it was described as a war on ethnic-based clubs, and there's still some rolling on attitude that
my favourite team in Australian soccer has always been Sydney Olympic, which is a Greek club.
Yep.
My 16-year-old son is playing for Olympic.
Right.
Now, today.
Yep.
You know, it's a great club. And yet, when I was the chairman of Soccer Australia in the NSL, the supporters of the NSL in Sydney were either Croatian, Greek or Italian. Supporting Sydney United, Marconi or Sydney Olympic. And if you go to most of their games, there was never anybody outside of those communities. Now, if your ambition for soccer in Australia was that it should remain an ethnic enclave, fine. But I wanted to see, and it's happening now, I wanted to see soccer move out into the mainstream of Australian sport and become embraced by mainstream Australian society. And it's happening with the A-League. And we could never... I tried to get the old ethnic-based clubs. You know, we had a terrible war. We're saying, gone are the days where we should be playing in European flags. Mm. And we said, let's have Australian strips, Australian... Let's appeal to Australians. So I don't want to pick out anyone, but they're all the same. One of the problems was that the boards of those clubs could see what was necessary. But if they went too far, they're going to be voted out by the ethnic block of votes. I remember Sydney United, which is a very proud Croatian club. I remember going, I understand. I went out for dinner as a guest of the board of Sydney United to the King Thomas Love Social Club in Western Sydney. And at Adenza Park, and an old man came over and abused me at dinner. and my hosts, the board, were extremely embarrassed because they were very gracious and proud hosts. But I insisted on understanding what the old man was trying to say to me. And so they translated, because he was speaking Serbo-Croat. And they translated for me, and what he said was, you know, we've for hundreds of years struggled for the independence of Croatia in the Balkans. In the early 1990s, we got it, and now you come along and tell us we can't wave our nation's flag at a game of football. The problem with Sydney United was nobody ever went to Adenza Park to watch a Sydney United game who wasn't of a Croatian background or connected with the Croatian community. They had over the turnstiles a sign that said Croatia Sydney. They were decked with the red and white checkered crest of the Croatian flag. They were selling... videos and books of Croatia. I mean, it was like going into a Croatian suburb or a Croatian town, and it wasn't. And I was saying, if you want, you and the crowds were 3,000 people.
I guess they were happy with that. They were happy with the 3,000 friends
Fine.
And neighbours.
But were we happy with it as an Australian Premier League, the National Soccer League of Australia? Who did we want to appeal to? We wanted to appeal to the Croatians, to the Greeks, the Italians, but every Australian. And that was what gave the momentum to that terrible 2-2 draw against Iran with the Socceroos. That was Australia's. Australia took ownership of it. It wasn't Greek or Italian or Croatian or Serbian or whatever. It was Australian. It was 100% Australian. And you look at the composition of the teams. You know, Mark Viduka, Mark Bosnich, Croatian. You look at, go through the whole team, and Paul Okon, Italian. Ned Zelic, Serbian. And you can go through and look at the backgrounds. It's the nursery, I mean, particularly the Croatians, just a few hundred thousand people in Sydney, concentrating in Sydney and Melbourne and Adelaide, have been the most phenomenal nursery of great Australian football talent. You know, Viduka at the top of the list for me. We wanted the game to appeal to a wider audience. Of course they wanted it kept that way.
We're more than 10 years down the A-League path now. What are your thoughts on where the competition's at and in its history?
I think they've done a fantastic job by introducing the A-League. It proved that you can have a national soccer or football league that appeals to all Australians. I think they've got to be very satisfied and proud of the achievement. But it's time to move on to the next stage.
And what is that?
Well, I told you that I was at a lunch listening to Ange Postecoglou earlier this year, a Dunbar Football Club lunch, and he made a lot of sense. He said, we've got to create more opportunities for talented Australian footballers and not wait until they're 36 years of age before they come back and play their twilight years in the A-League. And he pointed out that with only 10 clubs in the A-League, there isn't enough opportunity for young players to get placements. He made the point.
Limited places.
Yeah, and he's saying a typical A-League club like Sydney FC will at most take 4 new players into their squad a year. Yep. There are 2 teams in Sydney. That's 8 of all the hundreds of thousands of aspiring young footballers, like my son, who's 16, and he'd love to play professional football. You know, I mean, that's probably at the top of his list of ambitions. But next year, they're going to be 8 slots in A-League clubs in Sydney and 8 in Melbourne and 4 in Adelaide. And I mean, if Angie's figures are right, and I guess they are. So we've got to, I think the time has come to extend the size of the league. And I don't, with all due respect to Tasmania, I think the obvious scope for expanding the A-League is Sydney and Melbourne. Mm-hmm. I mean, half the population of Australia are in Sydney, over half in Sydney and Melbourne. So I think a third team from both is on the go. I also like the idea, always have, of promotion relegation.
You think it can be paid for and worked properly?
Yes. Yep. I think what you do is, I've always thought, not automatic promotion and relegation, but at the finals, because unlike the English Premier League, say, where you just have the competition and that's it, we have the playoffs. And while the top teams are playing off for the Premiership, the bottom two teams of the A-League play a round robin with the top teams of the major state leagues. And it may be that the bottom two teams of the A-League survive relegation by winning the round robin. And you would keep a great deal of interest in the bottom half of the competition because people, they face the risk of relegation. They've at least got to survive this round robin. And you give the opportunity of the top state league teams to play. Now, I'm not sure if that's got widespread support, but that's what I've always liked. So an extended number of teams in the National League, they've got to be very careful about spreading it too thin because financial viability. I mean, the old NSL, that was another problem. Most of the teams were stony broke most of the time. And the A-League has at least got something resembling viability. They've managed it well.
Expansion, A-League, how many teams should there be and in what time frame?
Well, I think you could move immediately for two more and introduce this round-robin relegation promotion idea. Look, there's another thing too. Most of the clubs that are alive to it, there's probably enough scope now for marquee players. I understand the theory of salary caps and of levelling the playing field. But it shouldn't be used as a mechanism for suppressing player payments. Players should be paid whatever they can get. Mm. You know, it's a short career. Most players don't go much beyond 30 years of age. They sacrifice everything for the football career. So they're entitled to earn what they're worth. And we shouldn't have salary caps designed to repress the overall payment to players as a vehicle for levelling the playing field. But I'd like to see pressure always to keep lifting the salary cap to enable players to get paid more money. And I think we've got to have even more flexibility for the marquee players so you can attract champion players. A point Angie Postecoglou made that I totally connect with, you don't want to have to wait until Harry Kewell's in his 30s. You don't want to have to wait until a Tim Cahill's in his 30s before we get to see him play.
Before we can afford him.
We'd like to see, yeah. Now, I think it's fanciful to think that we're going to deny these people the wish to go and play in the English Premier League or Serie A or La Liga. I mean, they're the top leagues of the world. And look at Brazil. Brazil's hardly got one player in its national team that plays in the local Brazilian league. They're all playing in the top leagues of the world. And I think that's always going to be the case. But I think the opportunity for Australian players to play more of their soccer or football in the Australian A-League would be a good thing.
David Hill, thank you so much for that chat. I really enjoyed it. It's
Me
great
too.
To get together with a survivor from November 29, 1997.
None of us really survived that day.
Things have worked out all right, haven't they?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
That's a good point you make. At the end of the day, it's only football.
No, it's much more important than that, surely. Thanks, David.
Pleasure.